And welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and very happy to have with me Michael Green. He works at the Nexus of Environmental and Health Issues as the executive director of that fabulous organization. He's on top of really important information that all citizens and consumers need to know about in terms of cancer, our health, what's out there that might be, you know, making us sick and we're not even aware of it. We can't count on the government to tell us what we need to know until it's sometimes years too late. I know personally that I cringe every time I hear about how dangerous BPA might be in terms of being an endocrine disruptor and impacting health, because I unknowingly fed my daughter, my only child, with a baby bottle that had BPA in it. It was a very common brand and, you know, just didn't know any better, or of course would never have done it, and as I'm sure millions of moms wouldn't have. They've gotten it out of baby bottles now, but we're going to find out from Michael Green what might be in not only bottles but cans, you know, for common foods and other things to be concerned about, just in case you were getting good sleep lately. If you started feeling a little bit better about climate change now that we got a movement with some muscle in it, no, there's more to be concerned about. But most of all, there's more to you know, learn about and do something about. Michael, welcome to the Green Front. Great to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Betsy.
So we ran into each other at an event, a TED event, about a month ago, and you were just talking my ear off. I said, I got to get this guy on. He is so knowledgeable, and there's a lot that, you know, even I, as a someone who covers the Green Beat, wasn't even aware of. So you mentioned something that you referred to as the toxic shell game, and that is kind of catchy and kind of concerning, and I wonder if you could tell us what you mean by that and what the Center for Environmental Health has been working on of late.
Sure, thank you. There's more than 80,000 chemicals being used by companies in the U.S. today. And there's no way that the government or anybody else has the capacity to test these 80,000 chemicals for their health impacts. So the vast majority of these chemicals are being used without us knowing the health impacts, and that means we're doing an unplanned science experiment on ourselves. And so when at the Center for Environmental Health we talk about the toxic shell game, what we're referring to is the practice where they take BPA out of sippy cups, just to use the example that you just gave, or baby bottles, and they say, well, we better take that out because there's been recent studies on it and there's been a lot of media on that and we might actually lose sales, or it gets banned in the context of baby bottles and sippy cups like it has been, at least in California, and we'll replace it with something else. And so then they make sure, okay, we're not going to replace it with anything on that list of a couple hundred chemicals that we can't use, but we'll replace it with something else that gives it the same properties. And so that could be, instead of bisphenol A, that's what BPA stands for, it could be bisphenol S, or it could be some other chemical cousin or chemical that has similar potential health impacts, or worse, or unknown, because they're switching out something that's known to be toxic for something that they not only don't know, but they don't want to know. The reason they don't want to know is because if they don't know, then there's no problem. There's no liability. There's no concern that they're going to get in trouble for it.
But there's a problem for us if we don't know and we unknowingly consume, you know, ingredients that have been exposed to these chemicals, or worse yet, give it to our children.
Right. So what we want to do is we want to create different incentives for companies so that they can actually have the incentive to know and proactively choose things that are healthy, as compared to not know and choose anything other than the few hundred things that are on the bad list. And so that's complicated for companies to do. I'm not saying that it's easy, but it's what would be most health protective for consumers.
Mm. And it's not only what we, you know, actually eat or drink, consume that way, but also what we put on our bodies. I know the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics and Environmental Working Group, and I'm sure the Center for Environmental Health have, you know, done a lot on, you know, the chemicals that most people assume must be tested if they sell it at, you know, Macy's or Nordstrom's, you know, some of the makeup and some of the, you know, skin creams and things, deodorants that are commonly sold. Most people just don't realize that if they're tested, it probably is, you know, from the manufacturer, and obviously there's a conflict of interest there.
Right. And so, for example, the lack of information that the consumer has available to them manifested in that there were a lot of personal care products that were advertised as organic. And so about a year and a half ago, the Center for Environmental Health did a small study to look at just the ones that were advertised as organic. Because it didn't make any sense that these products were being advertised as organic, so many of them. And we found a number of them had no organic ingredients. The only thing organic was the word organic on the box. And so then we sued those companies under a truth in labeling law, and they all agreed to either make their products genuinely organic or take that marketing off. But that tells you how little power the consumer has, that if they go in and say, well, I'm going to buy something that's got all organic ingredients, that they don't necessarily have the information they need to actually make real choices.
And how can we get the information? I mean, do we just need to support groups like yours?
Well, there's a number of things people can do. So one is that there is, in the EU, there are there's a very robust set of laws that are passed called REACH, Research, Evaluation, and Authorization of Chemical Hazards, REACH. And what REACH basically says is that you can't bring a chemical into the market unless you have some basic health and safety data about it. And so it's the opposite of what's here, which is that you actually don't want to know. And so those of us who are working to reform the federal legislation called TSCA, the Toxic Substances Chemicals Act, to basically provide more comprehensive protection for people. So one thing is they can harass their elected officials to support reforming TSCA to protect them, and that's something they can either do by getting on our list, and we'll be able to feed them stuff that they can send on, and that's CEH.org is our website, and people can then sign on, and then they will get action alerts. They'll get one action alert every 2 weeks that might go to a CEO of a corporation or might go to an elected official or someone like that, where they can actually have their voice heard. That's one thing they can do. A second thing they can do is they can err on the side, even though there's not perfect information, they can err on the side of buying products that, in the context of food, organic food, and in the context of non-food stuff, they can basically look at the label, and the more words it has that you are unable to pronounce, then the more likely it is that you don't want to buy it. And the other thing I was going to say is that part of it is that it's just that people don't have the system is backwards, and people don't have the ability to actually impact this process because they can't necessarily always influence it by their shopping.
You know, San Francisco some years ago passed a precautionary principle legislation. Do other cities have such, ordinances, and is that the way to go, for there to be more of a national precautionary principle movement whereby things are, presumed to be, dangerous if they're not proven to be safe, if that's maybe an inaccurate way to sum up what it is. But why don't you tell us more about it?
Well, what the precautionary principle basically says is better safe than sorry. And so how that manifests is to in situations of scientific uncertainty, to err on the side of caution. So you know that there are certain things that are inherently safe, and you know that there are other things that are inherently unsafe, say lead. But most things are, there's some ambiguity. So in the cases of where there's scientific uncertainty, to not assume that something is safe until proven otherwise. What happens when the city of San Francisco passes precautionary principle legislation, and we helped write that legislation, is that then the purchasing power of the city influences what is being made, because those are large contracts that companies will switch the way they make their products for the city, and then those products are available for everybody else too.
Other cities? Have other cities, taken, a cue from San Francisco?
There has been effort at the local level in a number of different cities, but the thing is that a city purchasing ordinance can only have so much impact. What we really need is something at the larger level. So that doesn't mean that people who are listening shouldn't advocate for things at their local level, but that's only one piece of the picture.
Mm. On your website, you have a project called MOMS, and that stands for Making Our Milk Safe Project. That is addressing one of the most shocking situations that I've come across in the 15 years of, you know, reporting on the Green Beat, and that is newborns have show exposure to, I think, more than 200 chemicals, trace amounts, granted, but who knows, you know, what grows from there if you're starting life with that kind of exposure, and not to mention what the combination, if you will, the toxic soup effect might be, you know, later in life. You'd think that that kind of news would have moms up in arms. Are more women starting to be, and men too, fathers as well, and just general citizens, you know, upset about the fact that something we're doing, or many things we're doing as a society, is exposing our, you know, newborns to, you know, potentially dangerous substances?
Well, there's definitely more attention to it than there has been in the past. And one way you can see that, if you go online, is just to see the large number of bloggers who are writing about this. You know, the mom bloggers who are writing about these specific things. The CEH Moms program was actually started by four mothers when they all had their first child around the same time, around 8 years ago. And they were motivated by the fact that this unplanned science experiment that I described earlier was sure affecting them, but was also affecting their newborns in a way that is much more profound than it affects adults, because children are not small adults. Their bodies operate differently. Their metabolism is faster. They breathe more air per body weight than adults do. They consume, they drink, and eat more per body weight than we do. And so they are being exposed at a higher rate, and because their bodies are still developing. So, you know, many people know that lead is particularly toxic for small children because their brains won't develop in the right way if they're exposed to too much lead. But there's plenty of examples like that. And that takes me back to, I want to say something about where you started off with the example of BPA. So the reason that BPA is a problem is because it tricks your body. Your body thinks it's something it's not, and your body thinks that it's a chemical messenger, maybe estrogen, that it is not. So then one's body acts in a particular way because it thinks it's getting a chemical message that now I'm supposed to do X. And so, especially for a small child to get the messages that now I'm supposed to do X, when actually that's not the case because it's not really the natural estrogen of that child, can result in very long-term health outcomes later in life as a result of that exposure early in life. To test for this is complicated, for this problem. And the reason it's complicated is you can't just say, okay, well, let's look for BPA, and if we make sure there's no BPA in, say, the baby bottle, then we're good. Because what we really need to be testing for in the case of this is estrogen-mimicking chemicals or chemicals that will trick your body, you know, other chemicals that will trick your body. So we are working with three different external laboratories, two are universities and one is a private lab, to do testing on different materials designed for children to put in their mouths or to come in direct contact with to see if they mimic estrogen. And it's done in a very different way than testing for a chemical, because we don't know what chemical we're testing for. Instead, we're actually testing by having human cells that will react to estrogen in a petri dish and seeing do they react to some ground up baby bottle there. And if they do, if they start to grow faster than they would otherwise, then because they're in a petri dish with the ground up baby bottle, then that tells you that the baby bottle must be giving that message saying it's time to grow.
That is both enlightening and frightening, Michael. Thank you. I want to talk about flame retardants, but before we move on to that, I noticed on your website an item about how certain Asian candies, you mentioned lead, contain lead. Ginger candies, that's my daughter's favorite. I'm going to go up and check our pantry and see if they're made in China. My goodness. How did lead get in ginger and plum candy?
12 years ago, we decided we were going to systematically test every children's product sold in the U.S. for lead and other heavy metals. And we started with the first one we found a big problem with was baby powder. Now, if there's a product that shouldn't have lead in it, it's a product designed to be put on baby skin where the skin is broken. And so we then sued all of the major pharmaceutical companies that were making these lead-containing baby powders. So that's Johnson & Johnson and Squibb and Pfizer and all of them. And they all agreed to what at that time they were calling the CEH standard, which was a very, very low, you know, basically no lead in there. And it turned out that the lead was in there as a contaminant, but they were making a conscious choice of using cheaper materials as compared to more refined materials. And then we replicated that same research and sometimes, when necessary, the same litigation for baby bibs and children's lunchboxes and children's jewelry and toys and candy. And so we have found a few different categories of candy that have lead contamination more often than not because one of the ingredients is contaminated. So the ginger candies are an example of that. Another example from a few years ago was chili-based candies from Mexico. And so the lead contamination was a problem that was easier for the bigger companies to fix than the smaller ones. So we then, part of the deal with the bigger companies is that they would have to create resources that are available for the smaller companies to replicate how to get the lead out of the candy.
Now, it's not going to say probably on the package of ingredients, you know, lead. So how would one know if, let's say, they picked up a package of China-made ginger?
Well, it's not necessarily China. I think one thing that they could do is they could look on our website where we have a list of the ones that we found with lead in them.
Okay, so maybe China's gotten a bad name. We tend to think of, you know, items, right, products made in China as being, you know, a little less safe because their government has less stringent filters, although it sounds like from what you're talking about, our government's not doing much better. Let's talk about toxic flame retardants.
I will tell you that the oversight of the manufacturing process in China is absolutely not as safe as the oversight in other countries, you know, especially, you know, the EU and even the U.S. And the biggest evidence of that is that as China's economy is becoming, you know, as they're becoming more social economic stratification, and there are a lot of high net worth people in China now who are purchasing products, they are purchasing products made elsewhere. There's a premium for buying products made in the U.S. in China.
Well, that's revealing and maybe some good news for our economy. Nice to be, you know, returning the favor since we are buying so much made in China.
You want to talk about flame retardants?
Yes. How did you know? I mean, I thought we got rid of that threat decades ago.
So decades ago, they banned chlorinated tris, which is a chemical flame retardant, in children's pajamas. But when that happened, that didn't mean that there was no other uses of those kinds of chemicals. Here's what happened, was that the tobacco companies were starting to get a great deal of pressure in the 70s because they of house fires, and they were worried they were going to be liable for thousands of house fires and for many millions of dollars of damage from house fires that were caused by cigarettes. So there was a movement to require that cigarettes are fire safe and that if you don't keep puffing on them, they go out quickly. But the tobacco companies didn't want to do that part in great deal because they didn't want to be liable for past fires. So they got together with the chemical companies and said, the problem is not the cigarettes. The problem is the furniture. The furniture is too flammable, and we need to fix this by dousing our furniture with these highly toxic chemicals that also slow down the rate of at which the foam catches on fire. Now, in reality, government studies have shown that it doesn't really work in the real world. It works in the lab because they're just testing the foam. But in the real world, the foam is covered by something, cloth or cotton or vinyl or something like that. And once those catch on fire, the flame retardants are not potent enough to retard the fire anyway. So they don't work in the real world, but they do make our worlds more toxic. And they make it more toxic for firefighters because the smoke, if there ever is a fire, is much more toxic. But they also make it, most importantly, maybe for small children, because the flame retardants gradually come out of the foam and end up in the dust on the floor, and then children who, especially very small children who are still crawling, are crawling around on the floor and then putting their hands in their mouth. Mm. And so so this is a very serious health hazard, and it's being driven to a great extent by California regulation that was sort of hustled through by the, at that time, very powerful tobacco lobby and the chemical lobby. So the Center for Environmental Health and many others have been able to sort of change the direction of that, and we're confident that in the next year or two, we're going to be able to have a situation where the furniture companies are going to want, are going to have the option to not use these chemicals, and then of course we're going to be working with them to try to prop up the ones who eliminate them first, and then call out the ones who are still using these toxic chemicals.
Well, that makes eminent sense. Like you say, they don't even work the way they're supposed to. But even if they did, especially with, you know, many fewer Americans, you know, smoking, which is probably, was probably one of the biggest causes of sofa fires, bed fires, that kind of thing, you know, what, it's relatively low risk. And yet, you know, children especially, and people sitting on their sofas every day, and kids crawling around on carpets, that's an everyday occurrence. So when
right.
you weigh the risk-benefit analysis, it just really seems that these things should, you know, be taken out of the system as soon as possible. So, again, thank you for the great work you're doing at the Center for Environmental Health. And I know Arlene Blum has been in the forefront of this issue for years.
So Arlene is a saint and a titan in this field, and she has been able to use her strong technical background and her you know, long-standing attention to this issue to really have a profound impact. And so it takes a lot of different types of expertise, her technical expertise and the expertise of lots of others to really make what, in essence, is a national change. One thing we have done recently is we tested a bunch of products designed for children to sleep on, nap mats, crib mattresses, and things like that. And we found that of the 24 we tested, 22 of them had these chemical flame retardants. 19 of them had more than one. And 10 of them had the chlorinated Tris chemical that was banned in pajamas decades ago. And so, and these are not subject to any of the regulations. These are not, they don't need to have those chemicals today, none of these products. And so, What happened is when we released our study, 23 U.S. senators said, as a result of the study, we want EPA to investigate right away the use of these chemical flame retardants in children's products. That was just last week.
Wow, hot off the press, so to speak. So I'm sitting here in front of two Apple computers, my laptop, my desktop. Both of them are maybe, you know, 2 to 3 years old. Is there any PBDE-like substance being emitted from my computer, your computer, everyone's computers, still in 2013, or is that no longer a concern?
There are specific flame retardants that have been that have been phased out, but then now we're back to the toxic shell game. So they replace PBDE with another chemical that might be a trade secret, so they don't have to reveal what it is, and is probably less well known and less well tested than that one, but might be a chemical cousin with the same potential health impacts. In this context, because they don't actually even work in the real world, it's ridiculous for us to be being exposed to these things through, through the dust in our homes or any place else. I wanted our scientists to test the dust in my house, so I took a bunch of dust out of my vacuum cleaner and brought it in a Ziploc bag, and it was full of different chemical flame retardants. And I'm sure that my home is no different than anybody else's.
What about EMFs? I know I'm bringing up a big topic with just about 3 minutes left in the interview and show, but you just reminded me that that's something of growing concern.
Well, we are living in an environment unlike any that we've ever lived in before. So my 6-year-old son and my 4-year-old daughter, they love to play with my cell phone. And to them, it's normal that they can actually pick up the cell phone and they can play a video game on my cell phone. But to us, that's a miracle that somehow something is being communicated from someplace else through the air. We can't see it, goes to my phone, and there my son can play Angry Birds on my cell phone. And so The problem with that is that what we do, again, it's about the scientific uncertainty, is we don't know the health impacts of all of those messages from all of the different things that we are now in a soup of electronic communication that the short and more concerning long-term health impacts on our bodies. So I think the most important thing is, one, for there to be stronger study around this, and two, for electronic manufacturers to disclose the information about the EMF from their products. So there's a movement to do that with cell phones, for example.
And we should mention that EMF, for anyone who might not have tuned into that threat, stands for electromagnetic fields, and it can come from anything from television sets to computers to cell phones, pretty much anywhere there's electricity. And it's a great concern. I have a teenage daughter, 18, and she almost always has her phone on, TV on, because she claims she has a little ADD and needs to have background noise on when she's doing her homework. You know, the laptop always, it seems to be connected to her, and she's a typical teen. And, you know, as an environmentally concerned parent, it's quite, you know, it's one thing, the crap that's on programming that's on television these days that they're exposed to, but that's not my biggest concern. It looks like we're out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. Michael Green, going to have you back. You can talk our ears off anytime. You are just a walking encyclopedia on this very important area of environmental health. Really thank you for all that you're doing at the center. Encourage people to check out your website at ceh.org. That does it for this edition of The Green Front. You can find the archives at prn.fm.